happy to have Dorota Grabowska visiting us from Washington. Mm-hmm. And I think she's going to be here tomorrow as well. So if you want to chat with her, she's around in fourth floor in the odd side.
No. 458 is the
415.
458. Where?
Yeah, oh, 458.
Yeah, where one of the Kaplans. Right. So I was like, did they think I'm my advisor or David E. Kaplan? Like either one of those would be fine, but I'm just
Aren't there two David B's?
Yeah, so I don't know about two David B's. I know there's definitely a David B and a David E.
Yes.
Who
he was here last week.
Right, so that's probably who's the office, but I was like, this is curious. Right. I'm like, I'm neither one of these people, but good try. Somewhat connected to them. Okay, with that start. So thank you for having me. So as my title very clearly says, I'll be talking about a non-perturbative regulator for chiral gauge theories, which is a formal field theory question. So then you might ask yourself, well, why did you insert this additional part to the title, these fluffy mirror fermions that seem sort of unconnected? And the answer is, so this, well, this started off as a project with a very sort of formal question of, you know, how do you regulate chiral gauge theories? Once we started working on it, we figured out you could also take this construction to be physical and then actually model build with it and ask the question, you know, if this is a physical construction, the standard model should have fluffy partners, and so how would that look? Hence the fluffy mirror fermions. So let me start on the formal side. So the big question, you know, the number one question we're trying to address is really, do chiral gauge theories make sense beyond perturbation theory? Right, so we really know of only one chiral theory in particle physics, and that's the electroweak sector of the standard model. This is, of course, weakly coupled. So any regularization that we do in the standard model, you can just do perturbatively. You know, for example, you know, Dirac is probably your best bet. But that's all perturbative. So the question is, you know, I really want to have a well-defined theory, so I really should know how to regulate beyond perturbation theory. So how do we do this? Can we even define a chiral gauge theory beyond perturbation theory? And the second question is, okay, if chiral theories make sense, if we have a well-defined chiral theory, what are their dynamics, right? What do strongly coupled chiral gauge theories look like? And this is a relevant question because there are BSM models that have strongly coupled dynamics. You know, case in point, the famous 5 and 10 bar of SU5. And so to really get at, you know, the structure of strongly coupled gauge theories, you should be able to calculate things in them. You should know how to regulate them. So for both of these, we first have to find a non-perturbative regulator. And just a quick note, I'm going to use non-perturbative and lattice interchangeably. For me, they mean the exact same thing. I don't really know of another way to non-perturbatively regulate in general. So feel free to choose your favorite word and interchange them. Okay, so in order to figure out why it is difficult to find a regulator for chiral gauge theories, let me first compare and contrast vector theories and chiral theories. So for vector theories, you know, our famous example is QED and QCD. And the important properties of vector theories is that your fermions are in a real representation. And so what this allows you to do is you can define a fermion mass term in a completely gauge invariant way. And the reason why this is important is one of the ways that we know to regulate a theory, one of the methods that we use to regulate a theory, is Poly-Villars regulators. So in this, you just introduce a new particle, Poly-Villars particle, that has some mass but opposite statistics. And if you take this mass to be heavy, you can cancel off UV divergences and regulate your theory. And the fact that you are allowed to have mass terms allows you to introduce Poly-Villars. And so, of course, there's also a known lattice regulator for QCD. This is where we get all of our strongly coupled numerics from. So for the vector theory, we know how to do this. It's been known probably about 40 years how to regulate vector theories. Now, to contrast that, if you look at chiral theories, for example, think back to the electroweak theory, now your fermions are in complex representations. And so if you do not introduce a Higgs, if you just have fermions and gauge fields, you are not allowed to introduce a mass term. So this automatically flows to not being known how to regulate them, right? So you say, okay, well, I'm going to introduce a Poly-Villars regulator. You know, I'm going to use that to regulate my theory. You can no longer do that because for polyvalars regulators, you need to have the same gauge coupling. So just like the fermions are not allowed a mass term, the polyvalars are also not allowed a mass term, and so therefore they can't control the UV divergences. So polyvalars doesn't work, and this is mirrored by the statement that there's no known proven lattice regulators for chiral gauge theories. And one of the questions that we're hoping to address is, you know, is this just a technical question, right? Is the solution that we propose, the regulator that we propose for chiral gauge theories, is this just a technical issue that we just hadn't figured out how to regulate them? Or is it actually indicative of new physics? So remember I had asked, you know, how do you have a well-defined chiral theory? Is there something in the way that we regulate them? Is there something about the regularization method that indicates how you can have a well-defined theory? And so therefore, you know, is there a problem with the standard model given the way that we actually have to regularize chiral gauge theories? And so we'll address this as we go through. Okay, so the technical question that we want to answer on the lattice field theory is how do you actually define a fermion measure for chiral fermions? So recall that observables are calculated by integrating over gauge fields with some measure. So for some observable F, right here, you do this sort of path integral where you have, you know, some gauge action here, your observable, and then this delta, which is your fermion measure. So it's well known how to define the fermion measure for Dirac fermions, right? You can just do the Grassmann integrals, you can integrate out the fermions, and for Dirac fermions, you just get the determinant of D slash, where D slash is your Dirac operator. So for Dirac fermions, this is well known. So the question is, well, if we know how to define the Dirac fermion measure, what about the chiral fermion? And we can get a hint about how we might want to do this, since you know that a chiral fermion plus its conjugate gives you a Dirac fermion. So you know that this equation has to hold, that the measure for a chiral fermion times the measure for its conjugate has to give you the Dirac fermion. Okay, so given this relationship, how might we define the fermion measure? So one of the requirements that we're going to have for this fermion measure that it has to give rise from a local and analytic action, right? We want fermions that preserve that are local, that give analytic results. So you might say, okay, I know that I have to have a local and analytic effective action, and I know that my fermion measure is going to be defined essentially by the square root of the determinant of the Dirac operator. So if you look at the spectrum for a Dirac operator, your eigenvalues come paired. So you can see that these eigenvalues are paired. And so to get at the fermion measure, you're going to take half of them. And now the important question is, how do you define which half you take, which root? Yes. So the horizontal axis is just the gauge field. So as you, it's a gauge field configuration. So as you're moving along, you change your configuration. Right. Right. So you have to take half of the eigenvalues, either the real or either the positive or the negative. And so you have to give a prescription for how you're going to choose which eigenvalue you keep. So the first option, you might say, okay, well, I'm only going to take the positive eigenvalues. So as you're evolving your gauge field, your eigenvalues will move around. So as long as you follow these, where there's no level crossing, that's fine. These are well-defined, analytic, local, so on and so forth. However, if you look at an eigenvalue that, as we evolve the gauge field, has a level crossing, it crosses zero, at that point, if you're going to take the positive branch, you have this non-analytic behavior there, right? There's a cusp. So this prescription where you say, I'm just going to take the positive eigenvalues, is not analytic. So it doesn't pass our test. So you might say, okay, well, if the non-analytic behavior is the problem, I'm going to again start off, I'm going to now start off at some reference gauge field configuration A star, and I'm going to take the positive eigenvalues for that gauge configuration and then follow them as I evolve the gauge field. So again, there's no problem as long as the eigenvalues stay positive, but now as you go to this level crossing, all of a sudden you have to pick, you have to take the negative eigenvalue. And so to write down a prescription for that where you're going to, sort of notice this level crossing, that's non-local, because you have to somehow know information about the full gauge manifold, so the global properties of the gauge manifold, not just local. So again, you're not going to have an effective action that's local and analytic. So neither of these prescriptions work. So a big part of defining a non-perturbative regulator is actually giving the prescription for which eigenvalues you take. Okay. There is another issue with doing the non-perturbative regularization, namely, again, that really we only know, only really lattice gives us a non-perturbative regularization. And so there's an issue with the difference between continuum field theories and lattice field theories. So recall that in continuum field theory, if you have chiral symmetries, you can have anomalies. So for example, in the standard model contains global symmetries that are anomalously broken. For example, the U1 axial in QCD, baryon number in SU2, so on and so forth. So the standard model itself contains these global anomalies. And here when I say global anomalies, I mean anomalies of global symmetries. And it's fine if we have these anomalies, we just need our lattice theory to respect them or reproduce them. However, now if we talk about gauge anomalies, we know that in the continuum, a chiral gauge theory that has an anomalous gauge symmetry is not well-defined, right? One of our requirements to have a well-defined gauge theory in the continuum is that it doesn't have any gauge anomalies. And this makes sense, because if you think about what a gauge symmetry is just a description of some redundancy in your system. So you don't want that redundancy to be broken. It doesn't really make sense to say that it's broken. So we require no gauge anomalies for a theory. So in a continuum, we know how to do this. This is well understood. Now, if we go to lattice field theory, the problem is that you are never going to see an anomaly on the lattice. And this is because anomalies inherently arise in a system that have infinite degrees of freedom. Lattice has finite degrees of freedom. So you're never going to see anomalies. You're never going to get the anomalous symmetry breaking. Now, for global chiral symmetries that are anomalous, the lattice has to explicitly break these symmetries. And it's been known how to do this since 92, when D.B. Kaplan came up with domain wall fermions. And so you know how to construct a fermion that gives you the correct, for example, U1 axial anomaly. So we know how to treat global chiral anomalies. However, when we come to gauge symmetries, this becomes more complicated because now the lattice must somehow distinguish between anomalous and anomaly-free theories on the lattice, but it can't actually see anomalies. So there has to be something that distinguishes a theory that's going to be anomalous in the continuum and anomaly-free in the continuum. So this is, you know, the big question for getting a non-perturbative regulator is how does the lattice distinguish these two sets of theories? And in fact, how does one construct a lattice field theory that gives you the correct continuum behavior, namely an anomaly-free or an anomalous field theory? So there's two ways one can go about doing this. The first is you can write down a field theory that has explicit gauge violation, right? So the lattice theory itself is not gauge invariant. But if you want to go into a continuum theory that has gauge invariance, you somehow have to restore that in the continuum limit, which seems reasonable. However, the problem with this is that somehow your continuum limit can only make sense for anomaly-free theories, right? So somehow in your construction, as you take the continuum limit, gauge invariance can only be restored for anomaly-free theories. And so this is problematic. This is hard to do. There are ideas about how to do it. There's another way that you can think about seeing differences between anomaly-free and anomalous theories. So for choice B, we're just going to maintain gauge invariance. We're never going to have gauge violation on the lattice. However, now you have to have a different mechanism. You have to have some mechanism that doesn't depend on anomalies because you're not going to see them, but that can somehow distinguish a theory that would be anomalous in the continuum limit versus anomaly-free in the continuum. And so this is the difficult step if you're going to maintain gauge invariance. You need another mechanism that allows you to distinguish these two types of theories. So we're going to go with choice B. And it turns out that for our construction, locality is what will let you distinguish the two. And I will show how that arises. Okay. So again, our goal is to define a chiral fermion measure. So there's sort of three steps we have to go through. The first is we need to have a global chiral symmetry. Namely, we need to have massless Dirac fermions that correctly reproduce the U1 axial symmetry anomaly.
Sorry, can I just interrupt and ask
you
about the previous slide?
Yes.
Does the opposite follow? If I have a local theory on the lattice, is it necessarily an anomaly free in the continuum?
If it's local. So I'm trying to think of the answer is yes or no. I know that all of the theories that have been sort of defined to try and get at chiral gauge theories, they were local, and they usually flowed to a vector theory. So I'm not sure if it's true that if you write down, well, so the problem is if you write down a local theory, are you thinking if you're a gauge invariant local theory or a gauge invariant?
Yeah, so a gauge invariant local theory on the lattice, is that what
the line is? I am not sure. I could imagine that could be true, but I'm not sure how I would actually go around proving it. The reason why I say that it might be true is I know that there's been other work sort of that worked with, actually it's like Grassmannian business, where you work with on-shell photons. The question is how you would distinguish anomalous versus anomaly-free theories if you're always working with on-shell particles. And what they find is that locality is also broken. That you only have a local description if you have anomaly-free representations. Though that is not by any chance, not by any means a proof. So I'm not sure, and that is something interesting to look at. Okay. So the first one is getting massless Dirac fermions. And the reason why we're interested in Dirac fermions specifically is when you're working in lattice, you can only really work with Dirac fermions. That's because Dirac fermions are the only fermions that have a well-defined eigenvalue function. Or I should say, chiral fermions do not have a well-defined eigenvalue function, so you can't integrate them out. So your sort of basic building block is always going to be a Dirac fermion. So you need them to be massless, so you can imagine having a chiral symmetry. But now, since you're always working with a Dirac fermion, you somehow have to decouple half of them. So you have to somehow decouple these mirror fermions, which are sort of the half of the Dirac fermion that you don't want. And then lastly, you need a mechanism for distinguishing anomalous versus anomaly-free fermion representations. So I'm going to go through all these steps. So for the first, let me show how we get massless Dirac fermions. So it's been known how to get massless Dirac fermions, as I've mentioned, since 92. And the way that you do it is via domain wall fermions. So the basic idea is that there's a famous no-go theorem that says that you can never have massless Dirac fermions on the lattice in four dimensions. So then it's obvious to try and go into an extra dimension and see what happens there. So you introduce an extra compact dimension, and it's shown here. So I'm just going to do it on a cylinder. And now, instead of introducing just a constant fermion mass, I'm going to introduce a domain wall mass, namely a fermion mass that depends on x5. So as I go around my compact direction or dimension, my fermion mass on this side is positive. Then as it hits this domain wall, it turns negative and then positive again. So essentially, I have a step function for my mass. Now, if you look at the spectrum of this theory, you can look at the 4D spectrum, where you can decompose your 5D fermion into 4D fermions, and you see that you get massless modes that are localized on the mass defects. So on one defect, you'll have this left-handed massless mode, and on the far defect, you'll have a right-handed massless mode. So again, this makes sense that we have both of them, because we're working with Dirac fermions. And so now, in order to see the chiral anomaly, you introduce gauge fields. And for domain wall fermions, you introduce gauge fields that are independent of the actual dimension, and they're only 4D gauge field, right? There's no fifth component to the gauge field. And so now you can ask, okay, well, how do I see the U1 axial anomaly? Which is a very good question, because if you're in an odd dimensional theory, you shouldn't see continuum anomalies, right? Continuum anomalies are inherently 4D creatures. You're never going to see, I mean, there's no sense of chirality in odd dimensions. So you know that there can't really be an anomaly in 5D, so how can you see one on sort of on your 4D brain? And so the answer is that there is an anomaly on this brain where the left-handed mode lives. There is an anomaly on the right hand, or the brain where the right-handed fermion lives. And then they're canceled off exactly by the bulk fermions. And so these bulk fermions essentially carry charge from one brain to the other, from one defect to the other defect. And this exactly gives you the correct anomaly. So the anomaly essentially due to bulk fermions carrying charge between the two mass defects. And this is what condensed matter physicists would call a topological insulator. Okay. So I just want to quickly show the 4D fermion spectrum. So again, I can decompose my action into a 4D action where I have an infinite tower of 4D fermions. So I'm going to have massless modes, and I'm going to have the left-handed mode localized at s is equal to 0, and then having an exponential decay. And then my right-handed mode is localized at s is equal to L, and also has an exponential decay. So now you can see why these are massless, or very, very light, because they have exponentially small overlap between them. So these are massless. And now I look at the bulk modes, which I have an infinite tower of, and you can see that they're completely delocalized. So this is why they are massive. And so now the theory contains a mass gap. You have these localized light modes, and then these bulk fermions, these bulk modes, have a mass that's on the order of lambda, where lambda is your defect height, or you consider it as your UV cutoff. So now you have a rigorous mass gap. And this persists when you include gauge fields, and it also persists when you go into the lattice and include a Wilson term. Yeah?
Are these profiles put in by hand, or is this some RS, like true RS model?
They are recovered. So if you take the 5D theory and you decompose, you do like a product basis decomposition, these are the profiles that you get. So they're, by the fact that you have this domain wall, they naturally arise from the theory. They don't have to be put in by hand.
What's the background geometry?
Well, so in this case, I have it compact, but you can also have it flat. So it's maybe I'm not answering this question right, but
how does it look, the geometry, the x dimension? Is that curvature? Is it warped?
No, it's not warped. Nothing
it's
like that.
Flat.
It's just flat.
Yeah. This is just the profile that you get around the source. There's some charge associated with the mass, and then this is the profile.
That I'm not understanding. So what I mean is, right. So okay. So maybe this will get at it. So if I write down this action, let me ignore the gauge fields for right now. This is my 4D, my 5D derivative, all right, lambda epsilon of s, right? So that's just my action. And then I can write, let me make these big.
You have a localized mass
term. I mean, not localized, it's a step function, right? So if I look in the extra dimension,
I see what you're saying.
It looks like this. So this is s is equal to.
Okay, so this is the epsilon.
Right, so this is the epsilon term. And so now when I have a mass defect, I can decompose these guys. Should I keep going, or are you?
I think I'm with you now.
Okay.
But the epsilon term is the domain
model. Yes. I mean, and so the reason why is it's, if you're working purely in lattice, you're allowed to do things like that, right? So it's, we don't question whether it's UV complete or anything like that. We just say, this is what we have. This lets us get the massless modes. Yeah, okay. Great, and so we have a mass gap with massless modes, and then modes that have a mass on the order of the cutoff. Okay, great. So now, of course, the natural question is, you know, could this setup give you a chiral gauge theory? And so with these, it doesn't seem like it could. And the reason why is, again, you can do this decomposition where you decompose the 5D action into an infinite tower of 4D fermions. And essentially, you can think about the extra dimension as not an extra dimension, but as a flavor space, right? So I can discretize extra dimension, and then this 5D derivative, or this derivative in the extra dimension, I can write discretely. And then essentially, N labels the position in the extra dimension. And we see that this gamma 5 ties together flavor n to flavor n plus 1. So essentially, I have a derivative that ties flavors sort of throughout the entire bulk. And so because of this, now you see that by gauge invariance, all of these fermions have to be in the same gauge group representation. So you're always going to have a vector theory. So with this setup, you can never get a chiral gauge theory. Okay. But we have massless Dirac fermions. So now we can imagine trying to find some way to decouple those mirror fermions and maybe break this vector gauge theory, gauge symmetry somehow. So an early attempt, which is done within a year of domain wall fermions coming out, is called the waveguide model. And in the waveguide model, the idea is, well, if I only want to see one mode, let's say the left-handed mode, why don't I just localize the gauge field around one of the modes, right? So I can imagine taking a gauge field that now depends on X5 and construct a theory such that around this domain wall where I have a left-handed fermion, I'm going to have a gauge field that's in the Coulomb phase. And then at some distance away from the domain wall, I'm going to transition into a Higgs phase. And then the fermions on the far defect only see the Higgs phase, so they never see a gauge field. So this seems great. Now if we can localize our gauge field around one of the defects, the far defect will never see a gauge field, so I should see a chiral theory. The problem with this construction is that as I jump across this sort of boundary, when I go from a Coulomb phase to a Higgs phase, that's not gauge invariant. So I have a gauge variant theory. So I'm going to introduce new particles that allow me to preserve gauge invariant. So I have some sort of spontaneous symmetry breaking. Now, if you take this model, you simulate it, and you ask, what do I see? Your spectrum has Dirac fermions. This was done by Goltermann, Janssen, and Vink. So it seems like you localized a gauge field around one defect. How do you get Dirac fermions? And the answer is that because you had to add sort of spontaneous symmetry breaking to maintain gauge invariance sort of across this boundary, you actually introduced a new defect. And now with a new defect, you have a right-handed mode and a left-handed mode appear at that defect. And so now the spectrum again has Dirac fermions because you have a right-handed mode right here that allows it to couple the left-handed mode. So this doesn't work. Now, our idea is similar in that we're again wanting to localize the gauge field around one defect, but we're going to do it via gradient flow. And so the idea behind gradient flow is that, well, first of all, it utilizes an extra dimension, which is always nice. But the idea behind gradient flow is we're going to start off with any gauge field, A mu, and this is just a 4D gauge field, and you're going to extend it into the bulk via gradient flow. So this is your gradient flow equation. So the nice thing about this gradient flow equation is it behaves like a heat equation. So essentially, as you're flowing out from one defect, your gauge fields, the high momentum modes of the gauge fields, get damped out. So now you can imagine if you flow sufficiently far, by the time the gauge field gets to the opposite boundary or the opposite defect, those right-handed fermions only see very, very low momentum modes. So you could now imagine some sort of decoupling effect.
Do you have a physical understanding? How do you try to guys come up with this flow equation? It looks like ad hoc.
So if I work purely on the lattice, I'm totally allowed to add ad hoc descriptions.
Yeah, that's true. But there must be a reason why, if physical understand why you...
Yes. Right. So now that we understand the model, there's definitely a couple of things that are nice about it. The first, well, you know, the fact that it damps out high momentum modes and allows a decoupling, that was sort of clue number one. The second is it's gauge covariant. So in the waveguide model, you violated gauge invariance by having the stepping, the sort of discontinuous gauge field. Since the flow equation is gauge covariant, as you flow your gauge field, you maintain gauge invariance. And so you never have to introduce additional fields. And I'll show how this is maintained. In terms of physical theories, it seems a bit ad hoc, but there's a couple nice properties that I'll go through that give it to us. Okay, so let me quickly talk about quantum gradient flow, because we want quantum gauge fields, and it's pretty much what you would expect. So you take your quantum gauge field, so A mu, It lives on the 4D boundary. And so this is where you have sort of your Yang-Mills gauge action is only evaluated with the gauge field that lives on the boundary. And then you're going to evolve your gauge field into the bulk via this gradient flow, which is completely deterministic. So the gauge field in the bulk is completely determined. It doesn't have any additional quantum properties. And this quantum gradient flow was due to Lucier and other lattice practitioners. Okay, so now let me look at an example, 2D and 3D, which will show why this gradient flow equation works. So in two-dimensional QED, I can decompose my gauge field into gauge degrees of freedom, this omega, and physical degrees of freedom, this lambda. And you can see that this is sort of the correct decomposition because under a gauge transform, omega shifts by that gauge transform and lambda does not. So now we put this gauge field into the flow equation and we ask how do the gauge degree of freedom and the physical degrees of freedom evolve? So the physical degree of freedoms have a heat equation, right, this box. It gives it some exponential softening as we go into the bulk. However, the gauge degree of freedom does not. So the gauge degree of freedom does not flow. It is unaltered as you go through the entire bulk. And so now you can see how we maintain gauge invariance because the gauge degree of freedom sees both the right-handed and the left-handed mode. And so this is what's nice about this flow equation. You can maintain gauge invariance while allowing your physical degrees of freedom to depend on the extra dimension. So for example, if we start off with some physical degree of freedom that has some amplitude at some momentum, as we go along into the bulk, this amplitude gets smaller and smaller. So again, the flow and the extra dimension damps out high momentum modes.
So you have full 5D gauge invariance, or is it a,
it's effectively 4D? It's 4D, right. Right. I mean, it's the same thing that you have with standard domain Wall fermions, right, where you assume that there is no fifth component of the gauge field, and you only have 4D gauge invariance. But there, you don't flow. You just continue taking, you know, the same gauge field propagates throughout the bulk.
Effectively,
you're
only putting in a 4D gauge
field. Exactly. Exactly.
Right. Are you looking at your non-trivial topology for the field? Because it cannot be gauged away.
Right, and so that's actually a very good point. And I'll talk about this. The question of what happens to topological gauge configurations is a good question. I'll get at the very end, I'll discuss why we think it's okay. Because you're right, topology can't flow away. So it would seem like the topology allows the two walls to talk. And there's some interesting things there, so I'll get to that. Right, so okay, so let me just focus on non-topological gauge field configurations for now. Okay, so
already the flow equation is some sort of non-topological thing because
what do you
cannot,
mean?
You cannot gauge it away. There is a term that you cannot gauge away, right, in the extra dimension. This epsilon u nu lambda
d. Right.
Yeah, that term, there is no gauge transformation you can do. To
exactly. That's the physical degree of freedom.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And so thinking about, I mean, that's what we care about the mirror fermions not coupling to, right? Because that's what, you know, we would see, right?
Yeah.
We would see the physical degree of free coupling. So we really only care about flowing away the physical degrees of freedom. Mm-hmm. That makes sense?
Kind of.
Okay. And we can definitely come back to this. Okay, so the general idea is we're going to localize our gauge fields at one defect via gradient flow. So you're going to have a gauge field that's quantum at s is equal to 0, so right here. And then your bulk gauge field obeys this flow equation that damps out the high momentum modes, which therefore means that the right-handed mode on the far defect now has a soft form factor coupling to the physical degrees of freedom. But the left-handed and right-handed modes couple equally to the gauge degree of freedom. And so this is what's different than in the waveguide model. Okay, so to understand how this decoupling works, let me again go into the flavor picture. So this is this decomposition into 4D fermions. So again, all fermions, including the bulk fermions, couple with the same strength to gauge degrees of freedom. Bulk and boundary have different form factors. And specifically, the right-handed mode has this type of form factor for the physical degree of freedom, where, so this C right here tells you how quickly or how slowly you flow. L is the wall separation or the defect separation. And then P is your photon momentum. And then lambda is your bulk fermion mass. And so again, with this, now the soft form factor, you can imagine decoupling the mirror fermions on the far boundary because of this factor. Okay. Great, so now we have an idea about how to decouple the massless fermions. Lastly, we need a mechanism for distinguishing anomalous from anomaly-free fermions, fermion representations. And so to do this, we can go back to this famous Callan-Harvey mechanism that was calculated or thought up of by Callan and Harvey in 84. And so the Callan-Harvey mechanism is just this idea that if you're working in a 5D theory and you integrate out the bulk fermions, you're just going to get a Tern-Simons action. Right? So essentially the bulk fermions that live, you know, throughout the bulk, if you integrate them out, all that's left is just a Tern-Simons. And you can look at that Tern-Simons to get an idea about how anomalies work. Okay, so let me focus again into three dimensions. So for a three-dimensional theory, this is your Tern-Simons action. So the important aspects of it to notice are the Tern-Simons can only depend on the sign of the domain wall, right? It can't depend on the magnitude, because you know that if you take the bulk fermion masses to infinity, the way they contribute to the anomalies must persist. So it has to depend only on the sign of the domain wall. Now, for the fermions come in with the sine function epsilon, because essentially their mass changes as you go throughout the actual dimension. And then we introduce polyvelars that allow us to cancel off the divergences from this infinite tower of fermions. So this is our Tern-Simons. And it's important to note that this approximation is only valid far away from the domain wall, mainly because we just sort of put in this epsilon of S by hand. You can also calculate this by just integrating out the heavy fermions, and you get the same answer. But the reason why I bring this up is whatever result we get from this Tern-Simons, it's not going to include the massless modes. This is going to tell us something about what the massless modes actually see. Okay, so let me do one more simplification. Let me go to abelian, so QED in three dimensions. So this is my Tern-Simons action evaluated with the flowed gauge fields. So a couple of things to notice. This projection, d mu d alpha onto A, this projects out the gauge degree of freedom. Similarly, this dd epsilon projects out the physical degree of freedom. So now this makes sense because of how we think about anomalies. Gauge anomalies couple gauge degrees of freedom from physical to physical degrees of freedom. So this Tern-Simons is exactly what will give us the anomaly. Now, this effective two-point function in here is non-local. It contains a delta function, but it also contains this term that depends on mu. And so what mu actually serves as an IR cutoff. And it depends on the defect height, the length of the extra dimension, and this parameter C that tells you how quickly you flow. So you might say, okay, if you calculated this correctly, the Tern-Simon is what it should be. If I turn off the flow, I should recover the standard domain wall case. So if I turn off the flow, C goes to zero, so mu goes to infinity, this gamma function disappears, and I have no Tern-Simons, which is exactly what you would expect. You know that the standard domain wall fermion case always gives you a vector theory. There should be no gauge charge being carried from one wall to the other. So this result is consistent with the standard domain wall fermion case. Now, in our case, we still don't want gauge charge to be carried from one wall to the other, right? Because the entire idea of this is to get at a 4D chiral theory, we only want to look at the fermions living on one boundary. So essentially, in some sense, looking at the effective theory for the fermions localized on one boundary. And if we have this Tern-Simons, right, if we have this Tern-Simons contributing to that action, it's a non-local action. That's not the theory we want. We want a local 4D theory. So somehow this Tern-Simons action has to disappear. So obviously, the only way to set this to zero is by going to the C goes to zero limit, which is a standard domain wall case. And we know that gives you a vector theory. So it can't be that. So let's see if adding multiple fields will do it. So if you add multiple fields, the Chern-Simons prefactor is just the sum of the gauge field charges squared times lambda over absolute value of lambda. So essentially the sine of the domain wall that you put in for each fermion species. So this theory is local if this prefactor vanishes. And now if you would look at this, this lambda over absolute value of lambda, the sine of the domain wall is just the fermion chirality. So what this tells you, for to have the 3D QED Chern-Simons vanish, you need the sum of the left-handed charges squared minus the sum of the right-handed charges squared, which is precisely the requirement that we use in the continuum theory to distinguish anomaly-free from anomalous chiral theories. So, right, this is exactly equivalent. This tells us that in this regularization, the way that one can distinguish anomalous from anomaly-free theories in the continuum is going to be non-locality in the lattice theory, and lattice sees non-locality, so this works. Okay, great. So using our fundamental building block of Dirac fermions, we can get massless Dirac fermions via domain wall fermions. We can decouple the mirror fermions using gradient flow, and we have a mechanism to distinguish anomalous versus anomaly-free representation, namely locality. So putting this all together in the formal sense, recall that our entire goal was to define a chiral fermion measure, essentially this delta that could then be used to evaluate observables. So our proposal is as follows. You take the determinant for domain wall fermions and the determinant for the polyvelars. So remember that the polyvelars come in with a -1 because they have opposite statistics to fermions. Then here, this big D slash is now the 5D Dirac operator, but you're going to impose this gradient flow on the gauge fields in that Dirac operator. And then lastly, you're going to have one factor for each species of fermion. And so we claim that if you were to model this or to simulate this, this will allow you to decouple large mirror fermions for large wall separation. And then your target D-dimensional theory is going to be local if the fermions are in an anomaly-free representation. And you can actually show that the effective action is what one would expect for chiral fermions, which I didn't show here, but we've done that calculation. So this is our proposal. Moving on from the formal lattice side, I promised a bit that I would mention these fluffy mirror fermions. So as we were working on this model, we started thinking, well, what if this construction wasn't just a technical way to regulate chiral fermions or chiral gauge theories, but what if it was actually taken to be physical? What if this wasn't just a technicality, but what one required to have a well-defined chiral theory? So in that case, if I take it to be physical, then it's necessary that the standard model fermions have mirror partners that couple extremely weakly. And so you'd be able to detect them via ultra-soft probes. Namely, if you manage to dip below that IR cutoff, this form factor will go to 1. So you start being able to see the sort of Dirac nature of this theory. There's many possible phenomenological implications, especially as you can also do flow for for gravity. So you can do Ricci flow for gravity. There is an open question about whether the Minkowski version makes sense, because if we're going to say this is a physical theory, we actually need to show this, and we're still working on that. But that's where the fluffy mirror fermions come in.
When you say, are you taking this to be a 4D? Some of our dimensions are compact.
So,
is there an extra dimension, or is it just. It's a 5D theory, and there's a small dimension, and you have this flow of gauge field in the.
Right. So one way to do it is to, you know, look at sort of in, you know, take the 5D. Extra dimension to be actual, like an honest to goodness, you know, extra dimension.
Yeah.
One can also take, you know, this discretized state and just work in the flavor, right? So there really is no difference between an extra dimension and an extra, you know, flavor dimension. We're sort of work with it, you know, equivalently. There might be a difference if you start thinking about sort of like UV completion, about where this flow actually comes from.
Yeah.
And so that's something that we haven't really thought about, but definitely needs to be thought about.
Yeah, now, as you were saying before also, non-trivial field configurations will affect it, right?
Yeah. Perfect. Yeah. Right, so this is the question is, when I did this decomposition into gauge and physical and then went into momentum space, I completely tossed away topology. So the question is, can fluff decouple from topological gauge configurations? And the answer would seem is no. You can't really flow away topology because it's topological. It's consistent that you can see that the flow now has multiple attractive fixed points. For example, an instanton solution satisfies the flow equation, an instanton won't flow. So with this, if you have instantons, you would naturally have, for example, TIFT vertices. And so it would seem that these TIFT vertices are going to link standard model and fluff, which seems bad. And so if the fluff can't decouple from topology, is this proposal doomed? And so we need to look at how our construction behaves at both strong and weak coupling. And so I will say that we don't really have calculations for this. It's sort of more intuition and a little bit of hand waviness, but there are simulations you could do to check this. But let me just go through how we think it might work. So at weak coupling, let me just look at the winding number 3 sector. So at weak coupling, I really only care about instanton configurations. So I'm going to have, 3 instantons. And as I flow, the flow won't affect the instantons. So I can imagine I'll still have 3 instantons on the far wall and probably in the same location. So is this problematic? Well, since the flow doesn't affect the location of the instantons, it seems highly likely that there's a correlation between where the instanton sits on one wall and where it sits on the other wall. And if there's correlation, then you're allowed to have energy and momentum flow from one wall to the other, which is bad, except that we're at weak coupling. So we know that all of these processes are incredibly suppressed, right? One normally does not care about, for example, a baryon number violation in the SU2 sector at weak coupling. Except maybe really high temperatures. But in general, since you're at weak coupling, it's a highly suppressed process, so difficult to observe. So I think simply by that, we might be safe at weak coupling. Yes?
So this is about the homology side, right?
Also,
question about the formal side, the homology stuff mess with you decoupling all of your...
Right. So I would say that they're almost one and the same. Almost, but...
Yeah, but that's the question of whether, it's kind of one that we ask the question of what we can measure.
Right.
In the formal side, it's the question of whether it decouples in the sense of you eventually get what looks like the chiral gauge theory you wanted.
Well, right, so... And now this is where we start to be careful about the statement of the chiral gauge theory that you wanted, right? So right, but it is, so... But it still is a difference, right? Because if you say, I know what a strongly coupled chiral gauge theory looks like, I would assume that I have a TIFT vertex that only links, the chiral fermions at S equal to 0. The fluff should completely decouple because that doesn't look like a chiral theory. So in this very strict definition of a chiral theory, what you might want to define a chiral theory as, you might argue that this doesn't give it to you. I would say that, but it does reproduce the only known chiral theory that we want, namely the standard model. So it is a question whether our preconceived notion of what a strongly coupled chiral gauge theory should be. So I agree. I mean, there's some discussion to be had about this fluff. Yes?
I also have a question about charge compensation. It's a very basic thing.
Okay.
So you're saying, how do they couple to gauge bosons? So let's say I scatter IME lay 2 electrons on our side.
Yeah.
And can they annihilate to those guys? Do they appear mini charged? Then what happens if I have magnetic models in my theory?
So right, so the problem is considering this in Minkowski space, it's a little bit uncertain, but if this...
Let's think about about the extra dimension. Forget about Minkowski for a second. Let's think about, let's say that you have this extra dimension.
Mm-hmm.
How
do these things couple? So, right, well, okay, so 99 I'll have to get to in a second. If I just think about the physical degrees of freedom, if I couple an E plus E minus to a photon, then I would assume that there's some form factor here. I want to assume, I know that these have a soft form factor. So then now you know that this momentum of this photon is going to be on the order of twice the mass of the electron. So as long as that mass scale is above the IR cutoff, then this is going to be incredibly suppressed.
Yeah.
Right, so the statement is that the fluff decouples for momenta above the IR cutoff.
Sure, that's fine.
Right.
But these will appear merely charged, right? Because these would be particles that have the same mass as the electron, or and they would have a tiny charge, right? If I don't care, it would be like a charge. It depends on momentum in a sense.
I think so. The statement of the Milly charge, I mean, because it's, I have this cloud that contains all of the charge, right? So the question is, how are you going to distinguish that charge?
They are composite in a sense?
So this is where it starts getting complicated, because I put in fundamental fermions.
Yes, exactly.
So, and normally you wouldn't think about fundamentals having form factors.
Yes.
But I'm not sure where the compositeness would come from, right? It might be in some way of how you get this flow, that actually the way that you get this flow.
This is what I'm suspecting. The question is, what happens if you start adding magnetic monopoles by hand? Because magnetic monopoles have to flux, so they're in principle, if you go around, there's a string, so
right.
It's a non-trivial field configuration. So the question is, if I think of the theory, let's say I start doing experiments below the IR cutoff.
Well, okay, so but then here's the question, but how do you get below the IR cutoff, right? So for example, right, so this is why the scattering is curious, right? Because if you have a mass gap in your theory, you can't really do any collision that will get you below that IR cutoff.
Sure, but I can assume that I have particles that somehow they are produced some other way, and I look at interactions of my low energy particles, I can still look at these, I can look them as an instant. And see what happens in that instant. How do I think about charge quantization in the theory? This is my confusion right now.
Right. So I wouldn't claim, I would not claim that these guys are Milly charged, because if I look at the gauge degree of freedom, they still see the full charge. But if I think about this form factor, this charge is somehow, so it gets a bit weird, right? Because you think, okay, if I have this like ball of charge, right, and I start probing it, right?
Yeah.
As I probe to higher and higher momentum to try and really probe where the charge is sitting, these guys you aren't able to see them, right? Because you start probing at higher and higher momentum. But if you start probing at low momentum, all of a sudden this form factor starts disappearing, so the sort of Milly charge aspect of them starts also disappearing. So I'm not actually sure that they would show up as Milly charged. Especially as I know that all of the charge of the electron is in there.
Yeah, but I can reverse, right? I can go, instead of going to high momentum, I can go to shorter distances in a sense. That's also
right, but if you go, I mean, but the shorter distances, higher momentum are they're connected, right? If you're saying I'm going to go to shorter distances, I'm probing at higher momentum by definition.
Yes, you are, but it doesn't have to be on shell, right? It can be off shell.
Or
another way to ask is, what happens if I consider magnetic monopole configurations in this theory?
Okay, so with magnetic monopole, so this is, this I might have a hard time answering. So, because magnetic monopoles are also topological.
Exactly, that's why, yeah.
And so, I don't know anything about them in the weakly coupled or the strongly coupled limit. So if they're weakly coupled, I would assume that you're not going to see them, because it's weakly coupled to highly suppressed process, and how you actually measure. But the thing is, I'm also not familiar how one would use sort of magnetic monopoles to measure. You're just thinking you'd see the flux somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Because you can just do an interferometer experiment. Just take some of them go around.
Right.
And I cannot even imagine how you would do this experiment, this setup.
Right. So. Right. So
but you can start adding them in the bulk, right?
Right. So I can start doing these sort of non-trivial windings around that dimension.
Yes, exactly. And then we'll see that the cutoff in principle, the scale lambda that you add. Right.
Right. So, right, and as I sort of, you know, flow, I wouldn't expect, you know, this magnetic monopole to disappear, so there might be some way to get them. But again, this question of whether, yeah, so maybe I should say I'm not quite sure, and it's something that definitely has to be considered, and we can talk about it more, because I don't think I can get at a good answer right now.
Okay,
good, so we'll continue discussing that. But right, you know, so, you know, not only these tit vertices, but, you know, these magnetic monopoles and so on and so forth are important. So let me, because I'm running out of time, let me just get to the strong coupling and then we'll discuss monopoles later. Okay, so now I go to strong coupling where I can't say, aha, it's highly suppressed, we can ignore it. But now at strong coupling, I also need to include anti-instanton configurations, right? This idea that at strong coupling, your gauge configuration is going to have many instantons. It's a very dynamical vacuum. So at strong coupling, you have instanton, anti-instanton pairs. However, the AI pairs themselves do not satisfy the flow equation. So now they are going to flow. So if you imagine starting on one wall with this, you know, sea of pairs and maybe three extra instantons, as you flow, all of the pairs are going to meet up and annihilate, right? And so eventually, if you flow for long enough, you're just going to end up with three instantons on the far wall. And so now you ask, is there still a correlation between sort of where my zero modes were on this wall and where my zero modes are on this wall? And if the correlation is extremely weak or there is no correlation, then there is no exchange of energy and momentum. So while you will still have a Tüft vertex that sort of includes the standard model and the fluff, since you don't have energy and momentum conservation, we're never going to know about the fluff. Because we're at our wall, everything is conserved as we would expect. And so this is just the statement that essentially if there's chaotic dynamics, you have uncorrelated operators, and so this is what you would imagine your Tüft vertex would look like, where this operator O is on one boundary, and this operator O prime is on the other boundary, and you have a 1 over V4 suppression. So this is how we think you might escape this issue from strong coupling, where you're just not going to have energy and momentum correlation, or not going to have energy and momentum flow, so everything still looks like it should on your near wall. Okay, so for the summary, this is our proposal for the fermion measure for chiral gauge theories. It combines domain wall fermions and gradient flow. The gradient flow allows you to decouple the mirror fermions, and then locality will tell you if the chiral fermion representation is anomaly-free. And then on the phenomenological side, you know, the question is there fluff hiding in the standard model, and is this the beginning of the low energy frontier? Thank you. Yes. Oh. Yeah, I was like, I was all ready to call on you.
So this three-dimensional inference on this, like, what happens in higher dimensions? You don't get it.
No, it persists. I mean, it's the same thing. If you say, you know, I want a 4D chiral theory, you look at the 5D Trans-Simons, and the exact same thing happens. You get this non-locality, and then if you want that Trans-Simons to be zero, you again have the same requirements for anomaly-free, you know, the anomaly-free representations that you have in 4D. So it persists.
I guess my other question is, it's not obvious to me how in some RS model where you can use this gravity, you get the same kind of gradient flow equations for the gauge fields. I mean, you know, it's true for curvature, but how does that show up in the gauge field?
So the answer is I don't know. So again, you know, so as you know, since we're working on the lattice side, we just went, aha, gradient flow, right? So this question of, you know, how do you actually generate this gradient flow, so on and so forth, is something we haven't looked at, because on the, you know, pure lattice field theory configuration, we don't need to explain where it comes from. We can just use it as a tool.
Yeah, that's what you want.
Right. now obviously if you go to the physical, you know, if it's a physical construction, then yes. You know, and I have talked to some people that have sort of, were trying to get the same sort of decoupling, and they, I believe, had some, you know, 5D theory with, you know, sort of KK mode that could sort of get this type of almost gradient flow-like object. But I think in...
You said gate flow. electron
was gained
in the bulk.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, but there you actually have charge flowing off.
Exactly. There you see it, right?
Right.
You have like essentially you have some composite quarks of a tiny.
Yeah. And so with us, we know since our target theory, we want, you know, in some effective region of momentum space, we want a 4D chiral theory. We don't want flow running. We don't want charge running away into the bulk, because we know that in a 4D chiral theory, we shouldn't have charge running away.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So in that case, this is why I'm like, it does look like a chiral theory because we don't have charge running away, which is nice.
What happens
with
all the fermion KK modes?
So they're heavy.
As you try to bring this mu down, right? These guys are going to come down with it.
Not necessarily. So.
There's the mass.
Right. Exactly. So, mu ir is the square root of lambda cl, and then the mass of the bulk is going to be on the order of lambda, right? So as long as, essentially, if your momentum, oh goodness, that moves. There we go. wrong way. Let's make it something like that. Right, so as long as you're in this window, your theory looks like a chiral theory. So then you can imagine probing two directions, right? You can probe at higher energy and try to start producing these KK modes, or you can probe at low energies and start seeing what you thought was a chiral theory somehow start looking more like a Dirac theory, which is also really weird to think about.
Sorry, do you have a big hierarchical separation between UIR and lambda? This is a 5D theory.
Mm-hmm. Take L very, very big, or take the flow very, very fast. Yeah, you know, so if you really wanted to get, if you really wanted these guys to decouple apart, you know, from topology, you can imagine taking your extra dimension to infinity, which would you take, you know, your mu ir to zero. So then you would have a chiral theory at all energies. But topology kind of screws with that idea because you would still see them in topological configurations. But
yeah, see, that's the thing. This is like topology knows about these guys in their full glory.
Right. So
this is the confusing part of this.
Yeah. No. I totally agree that the sense of topology is very is weird, especially. There is some paper, and I unfortunately don't understand it well enough,
yeah.
that states sort of that, you know, on the lattice side, that if you want, you could do lattice simulations at fixed topology in the trivial sector, and then if you take the volume to infinity, you can actually recover all sort of results, including non-trivial topological results.
Yeah.
And the reason why lattice people don't do it is because then the volume effects don't go exponentially; they go with as power laws. So then, but in this case, if I do this at zero in the trivial topological sector, the fluff completely decouples.
Yes.
So this confuses me to no end. I think there has to be some assumption that we break that violates this result that other people have found with the trivial topological sector.
Yeah.
But I agree, the topology of this is all sorts of confusing. Any other questions? Yeah.
Is there anything interesting about the sign problem in this?
Yes. There probably is a sign problem. Because you would expect. Well, so the thing is, I don't know how bad it is, right? Maybe the universe is merciful. And for some reason, the sign problem in this is small. You know, its effect is small. So you can imagine doing some sort of work, right? So think about if you do. Lattice QCD with a finite chemical potential, if it's a very small chemical potential compared to the temperature, you can take it to be imaginary, do calculations, and analytically continue back. And I think there has to be less than 1/1 the number of colors, I think. So as long as you're in that little regime, then it's fine. So maybe there's something similar here where in some regime you can simulate them or there's some nice limiting factor. You know, the reason why the sign problem is problematic is you say, okay, well, how would I actually check this? I have a sign problem. I can't numerically simulate this. So all of this sort of hand-wavy stuff that we have for the topology, you can't check. But there is a way to check it. So you might say, okay, I know that the sign problem shouldn't be there if I simulate a vector theory, right? So now, if I look at my extra dimension, let this be S equal to 0, let this be S equal to L. If I put a chiral theory here, I'll have a sign problem. If I put a vector theory here, I won't. So put QCD, let's say, with one flavor. So then you'll also have QCD with one flavor here. And now you can start, you know, or if you want, you can do two flavors because it's a little bit better understood. And now you can start seeing correlations, right? Because if you do the one flavor case, if there's non-trivial communication between the two walls, it'll look like two flavor QCD, and so you'll see pions. And since you're simulating a vector theory on the wall, you wouldn't expect a sign problem. So this is the test that we think should be run numerically, is simulate QCD, essentially, and see whether you find what you would expect for the amount of flavors you put on one wall or not. Any other questions? All right, thank you.